behalf of Appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Major Patera, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Captain David Bosner, and along with my co-counsel, Captain Ryan Cirkovich, we represent the appellant in this case, Senior Airman Gerard Simmons. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
This case is about the government making a change to the charge sheet after it rested, when prosecutors realized the evidence actually presented did not match the charge and specification as preferred, referred, and arraigned. This was a major change over defense objection and not preferred anew. Now I'll get to the major change piece momentarily, but where I'd like to start is by addressing the big picture of what the government advocated for in its brief, which is that it was not only legally acceptable, but perfectly reasonable to wait until after it rested its case to then ask the military judge to conform the charge sheet to the evidence that had already been presented at trial. This is a case where such evidence was in the government's possession before arraignment. Defense counsel relied on the failure to amend the specification by revealing an opening statement. He was going to attack the sloppily charged dates, and we'll come back to that, he said. And both parties spent the whole case establishing timelines and critical dates, the words of the trial counsel. Dates were indeed, to borrow this court's phrasing in United States versus Parker, a major focus of the litigation. This context reveals a fundamental concern with fairness, justice, and due process, even from a lay perspective.
Now, what about the argument by the government that the preliminary hearing officer had this information in front of him? The defense was there, and so this date was floating out there anyways.
Your Honor, this specific date was not floating out there. The evidence, or the discovery as it may be, came to the government's possession the weekend before trial, when the trial counsel requested that CL, in this case, go back through her Facebook records and see what she was able to develop. She then went through and screenshotted what turned out to be 252 pages, and that was turned over to the defense on Sunday night. So although the preliminary hearing officer did discuss concerns with the dates as charged, the actual evidence associated with that didn't materialize until the weekend before trial. But perhaps the more
crucial... I'm referring specifically to the fact that in the preliminary hearing, the preliminary hearing officer wrote that this would ostensibly be September 2013, based on the victim's reference to boot camp and so forth. So that's what I'm referring to in terms of the date floating around.
Yes, Your Honor. I think perhaps the crucial point here is that the government chose not to amend the charge sheet before arraignment, even in light of the additional evidence.
And indeed, the preliminary hearing officer didn't use that date.
Exactly, Your Honor. And as this court noted in United States versus Reese, the defense is entitled to rely upon the charge sheet, and perhaps more importantly, the subsequent decision not to amend the charge sheet heading into trial. So what we have in this case is the defense counsel presumably aware that the dates as charged are not in conformity with the discovery and evidence that would be presented at trial. And the defense counsel, upon that entitlement of reliance, walked into the opening statement and identified for trial counsel, military judge, and the members that he was going to attack the sloppily charged dates, and that's exactly what he did. Now, this change was major for several reasons. The one I'd like to start with is looking at RCM 603A and its discussion section as an initial matter.
Before you go on with the major change question, so you began by saying that this is really an issue of fundamental fairness. There's an argument you made that Rule 603, just even as written, if we just take it at its word and the distinction between minor and major amendments, is fundamentally unfair. It is just too generous to the government. That's not your opening argument. Or is your argument that in determining whether these changes were minor or major, in sort of following the steps of 603 and this court's precedent, we should keep fundamental fairness in mind?
It's more the latter, Judge Hardy. When this court reviews 603A, its discussion section, the whole construct of 603 and the case law that's interpreted it, fundamental fairness is something that ought to be kept in mind. Noted in dissent in United States versus Stout, perhaps fundamental fairness is something that ought to be considered when notice comes from the charge sheet, the formal document that's in the government's possession from its inception all the way through the end of the court martial. And when the government gets, quote unquote, the full picture of evidence at trial, how is an accused supposed to have the full picture to adequately prepare his defense? Fundamental fairness is something that seems to be inherently infused into RCM 603 and its distinction between major and minor changes, because perhaps if it were minor and non-prejudicial, concerns of fundamental fairness may not loom as large. But that's really not the case that we have before us. What we have before us is not a change that was made to correct an inartfully drafted specification, nor was it made to correct a misspelling in my client's name. This specific date for the extortion specification, August 2nd, 2014, was a date that was specifically elected by the government in a charging decision, a date of legal significance, the date when CL turns 16. So it can hardly be argued that this is to correct inartful drafting when it was drafted as desired in conformity with litigation strategy. And this is exactly what this court unanimously discussed in United States versus Reese. And this is not the type of change that is on par with those articulated in the discussion section. It doesn't fit into that category of slight errors, because this error was not merely non-substantive, but it actually overhauled the entire sequence of the litigation.
This almost seems as if you're injecting prejudice into this. Wouldn't your posture be that if it's a major change, you don't need this prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor, if it's a major change, you don't need prejudice. 603B and Reese make that abundantly clear. And I appreciate that point being made. Prejudice is not necessary, but prejudicial concerns are things in the factual context can demonstrate that it was a substantial matter not fairly included in the previous referral and that it was likely to mislead Airman Simmons, because perhaps if he was indeed misled, which would be prejudice under 603C, he would also have been likely to be misled, which is one of the enumerated major change categories in 603A.
So let's tease that out a little bit. Let's say that it's simply a change of 279 days. Without the number of other points that you address here. Is that a major change?
Under the facts of this case, yes, Your Honor. Never before has there been a clearly defined bright line rule of how many days is too many to be considered minor. However, in this case, 279 days is so far beyond wherever that line may be that indeed that is major on its own accord. But especially when you consider the 279 days in combination with the fact that the dates in this case were a major focus of the litigation, every component of the court-martial was focused on the calendar, the years, the seasons, the days of the week, the months. Dates were, on the facts of this case, surely major.
Now, in that regard, as you've correctly pointed out, there isn't any firm standard. What is your position in terms of how this court should address that issue if we were to agree with you? So we would be providing guidance to the field in terms of we've got on this side of the spectrum on or about. That provides some leeway. But there is some point on that spectrum, and it's your position that once you're to 279 days, you're there for a major change, standing alone. What do we do as a court in terms of providing guidance to the field about how they know in future cases where that dividing line is.
Your Honor, as a starting point, trial practitioners are going to review the way this court has decided major minor changes before. Necessarily, that includes some of the variance case law with the honor about. So I think we as trial practitioners can start to begin to put those cases on a spectrum. And then it's our duty to then look at the facts of our case and perhaps liken it quantitatively, but also develop the factual circumstances. For instance, if we look at United States versus Stout, also changes in the range of 260 to 300 days. That case, though, was posturally different in that there was an Article 32 in 2012, a change came in 2014, and there was a trial in 2015. So, as noted in that case, there was no way that the accused could have been likely to have been misled. He was on more than abundant notice. Whereas in our case here, that change didn't happen until way too late.
Partial difference is that was done before referral. Here it's after referral.
Exactly. And that's a huge critical distinction that we find in several of the cases, starting with Brown in 1954 through the Army Court decision in Witt, which was referenced in the major change objection posture, and Stout. It's a critical distinction if the change happens post-32, pre-referral, versus here where we're post-arraignment, post the government trying their entire case post-resting, and the defense saying, I'm not going to present a case, we're heading into instructions, and then it gets changed. That is qualitatively and supremely a different situation.
If you could please address the issue of how Reese might apply here. In terms of the change in dates resulted in a change of the means because it became an extortionate threat that caused the sexual act to occur.
Yes, Your Honor. Reese is applicable to our case in several ways. First is, as already noted by Your Honor, prejudice is not part of the major change calculus. Second, the accused in that case was not on proper notice, even though the evidence or discovery came to light from a pretrial deposition, because of his entitlement to rely on the charge sheet and the decision not to change the charge sheet before trial. That's also a critical similarity in our case, where defense counsel was aware of the difference but didn't have any formal notice the government was going to prove a case in conformity with this new discovery. But in terms of the means of committing the offense discussion in Reese, there's an argument that this did change the means of at least committing the Article 120B offense, and that goes to the intricate linkage, in the military judge's words, of how these two specifically separated offenses on the charge sheet were now reversed in order. So you had an extortion cause a sexual act with a minor. And that was not what was charged, and that's not what a defense counsel or an accused would gather from the charge sheet, because there was a definite break in the chronology from where the Article 120B specification terminated and where the government specifically chose to begin the Article 127 offense. So that perhaps changed the means of committing an offense, but it surely was likely to mislead appellant because he didn't understand that that was going to be the case the government sought to prove. And that is also a substantial matter not fairly included in the previous preferral. The charge sheet associated with the previous preferral and the evidence associated with the charge sheet at the previous preferral in no way indicated to appellant that that was going to be the case that he ought to defend against.
Counsel, on that point, could you just answer a very specific question? You mentioned in your brief that because of this change was made after the fact, that this impeded cross-examination that was done. How would the cross-examination, what additional cross-examination questions might have been asked?
Sure, Judge Maggs. The first point is that the bookends of the cross-examination, everything in between, did not approach the possibility that the sexual act that occurred on or about December 31st of 2013 was procured by threat. Because at that point, the cross-examination was surely focused on the calendar, as it all was, but the act and the age, which were the only two elements of the 120B offense. But the Article 127 offense, where there's a different set of elements, you can look at JA 130 and 131. Defense counsel specifically confirms that the threat happened outside the charge time frame. And there's hardly a reason why defense counsel would ever confirm elements in that way, unless he were doing so because his trial strategy was that he was going to attack the sloppily charged dates. And as mentioned in opening statement, he was going to do so. And he was never able to walk in front of the members and say, ladies and gentlemen, my client's not guilty as charged, because the government offered evidence and testimony that is simply not when it was alleged to have happened. So in summary, Judge Maggs, the cross-examination would have focused more concretely about sequencing, so a threat causing an act, and perhaps it would have, Your Honor, see my time has expired. May I conclude?
Yes.
The cross-examination would also have, would not have specifically confirmed that a bad act happened, but it was merely outside the charge time frame.
Can I ask one question?
Counsel, in response to Judge Wilson's questions earlier, you've been focusing very much on the discussion of 603A, which I completely understand, because I think there's some considerable tension between the discussion and the actual text. But he asked you about, is there a point at which a delay becomes just sort of per se too long? Would we not still need to put that delay into one of the enumerated buckets in 603A, or could we just judicially create a new rule, as this is what you're asking for, that a change of a certain magnitude at some point is just per se a major change, regardless of whether or not it fits cleanly into one of the enumerated buckets?
Your Honor, if a change is of a certain magnitude, at some point it's going to be a substantial matter, not fairly included in the previous referral, and it's going to be likely to mislead an accused. If there is a certain quantity of days that this court has in mind that is so far to the right on this spectrum, the court can neatly fit that that quantitative analysis into the 603A text by saying it's a substantial matter, and that this number of days is just going to put the accused perhaps on notice, likely to mislead him that he or she is defending against the wrong charge and specification.
But we still need to do the analysis, figure out how that large change either misled the accused or included a new substantial matter, right? It wouldn't be enough just to say, like, a year is too much, and it must have, just per se, must have misled the accused.
Your Honor, that could be a good starting point. Perhaps a year is too much and it must have misled him, but let me tell you why the facts of this case he was likely to be misled, and why these dates were not fairly included in the previous referral. I believe it could be a launching point to further RCM 603 discussion, perhaps a presumption of it being a major change if we exceed a certain amount of time. However, the facts of this case clearly demonstrate that all the 603A subcomponents as identified are met. Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Patera.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major John Patera, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Marilyn Payne, we represent the United States government in this matter. This court should find that correcting the start date for appellant's extortionate threats was a minor change that did not prejudice the substantial rights. As such, it was freely permitted at any point up to or prior to announcement of findings.
Now, counsel, before you go, I'd like to go on. I'd like to raise a point that was raised by appellant's counsel. In your brief, page 40, you say it is, quote, reasonable for the government to wait until after a victim testifies, before deciding whether the dates of the charged offenses need to be corrected based upon the evidence adduced at trial, end quote. Why shouldn't this court recoil at that assertion by the government? It seems to strike a very cavalier attitude towards the investigation, the charging, and the prosecution of the case for the government to say, we'll wait and see halfway through trial what the evidence shows, then we'll change the charge sheet.
Your Honor, it certainly wasn't the government's intent to strike a cavalier tone in our response. But I think in answering that question, it's important to draw a distinction between what would be best practice for the government in preparing a charge sheet with a teenage victim and what the law allows with regards to amending the dates of a charge time.
Well, again, you say best practice. What we're talking about here is fundamental fairness. The ability of an accused to know what he or she needs to defend against. So I'm concerned about the phrase best practice as compared to what is actually required of the government.
Certainly, Your Honor, what's required of the government is what's contained in RCM 603 paragraph A. And when I say best practice, it actually would allow the government to avoid some of the pitfalls that are associated with making later changes or later amendments to the charge time frame. So in this instance, best practice would have been for the government to amend it or to charge it in the first instance broad enough to encompass all the three different pretrial statements of CL where she was uncertain about the dates, have that broader charge frame. But barring that, when they received the additional evidence the weekend before trial, it would have been to amend the charge time frame to encompass those Facebook messages. And when I say best practice, it's even if only for purely self-interested matters, the government can save itself some headache and save itself from looking bad both to appellate courts and to the members at trial. In delaying making the amendment, the government increases the risk that it could mislead the accused based upon some reason that's unknown to the government, some reliance on
that happened here. We've heard a litany from appellant's counsel about how this affected their defense during the court martial. So why did that not happen here?
Certainly, Your Honor. So as a factual matter, there is nothing in the record to suggest the defense relied upon the dates of the offense in preparing their trial strategy. A reasonable trial strategy is not created in a vacuum. It's shaped by not only what the notice is on the charge sheet, but the additional notice provided through discovery. And in this case, CL had provided no fewer than three different pretrial statements where she was very unclear about what the dates of the offense were. She alternated between tying it to him returning from boot camp in the fall of 2013 to it happening after she turned 16 on 2 August 2014.
And the government knew that. The government was present during the preliminary hearing. It was the government's witness. But what appeared on the charge sheet were different days than what the victim had told the government.
So the government appears to have tied it to a particular statement. And again, not defending that as a best practice. But that's different than saying that the appellant was misled, as a matter of fact, or that the mere amendment of dates constituted a substantial matter not fairly included. Because as Judge Hardy indicated, it would be difficult to fashion a bright-line rule regarding dates without tying it back to the specific enumerated exceptions to what constitutes a minor change contained in subparagraph A. And as a factual matter in this case, the defense in setting their trial strategy, it was not to rely on the idea that the extortionate threats did not occur in the original charge time frame. And we know this because trial defense counsel articulated what his defense would be in opening statement. It was to attack, as a factual matter, whether the picture constituted an extortionate threat. And that was eminently reasonable given the discovery that had been provided, which included not just the statements from CL, where she was very clear that the extortion began in high school and continued on through his active duty service, but also appellant's own statement to OSI, where he admitted to taking a picture of CL immediately after she finished performing oral sex on him, admitted to joking about having that picture, admitted to discussing oral sex with her after he entered active duty, and admitted that that he received a partial blowjob from her at some point in 2014. And so given that lay of the land, so to speak, it was eminently reasonable for trial counsel to rely upon the trial strategy that they did just based upon those pretrial statements, it became even more reasonable when the Facebook messages came to light showing that the extortionate threats happened earlier in the charge time frame. And so if we're looking at those specific enumerated buckets in 603 subparagraph A, just as a factual matter, there's no indication in the record that appellant was misled in his trial strategy or that correcting the dates of the extortion to actually reflect when they occurred somehow required a fundamental change in trial tactics. And that's a consideration from United States v. Brown in the 1954 CMA case.
But, counsel, in terms of prejudice, appellant's counsel just said, well, we would have done the cross-examination differently. We wouldn't have confirmed that a threat occurred at the time of a threat was outside of the charge period. In that sense, they're saying that, in fact, they did rely on this and were prejudiced.
Well, Your Honor, certainly on appeal, appellate counsel has argued that. But I think this court can look back to what trial defense counsel argued at the time of the motion to figure out just what the additional cross-examination that would or would not have happened. And trial defense counsel did briefly refer to some hypothetical additional cross-examination to probe the nature of the threat and whether CL felt that she was under threat when the sexual act for the ARPA 120B offense occurred, but didn't provide any more specificity than that. And this gets back to the idea that, as discussed in the brief, that there was pretrial notice provided that the extortion threats began pre-service and continued. That evidence was admitted without objection at trial well before this motion to amend. Trial defense counsel had every opportunity and every incentive to cross-examine her on these topics if that was consistent with their trial strategy. And more importantly, once the government succeeded on the motion to amend, the defense still had its case in chief. They could have recalled CL for additional cross-examination. Certainly trial defense counsel foreclosed that, but he had that as an opportunity. He could have called additional witnesses to it. He could have requested a continuance. Didn't request any relief beyond raising an oral motion for a directed verdict under RCM 917, not for the original charge time frame, but for the amended charge time frame. And I don't know if I answered your question, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Let's assume for a minute that there was no change in dates to the charge sheet in the middle of the trial. Would the conviction have withstood scrutiny by the CCA on factual sufficiency grounds if, in fact, the evidence adduced at trial showed that the offense occurred 279 days before what was charged in the charge sheet?
And if I understand, you're drawing a distinction between whether the government would have prevailed on a 917 motion in the original charge time frame or if the convening authority, the Court of Criminal Appeals, would have said it was factually insufficient just for the charge time frame.
Right. That the evidence adduced at trial didn't match up with the charge because of the 279-day difference.
So I think the government recognizes that the stronger proof for the extortionate threats come from the Facebook messages and CL's testimony, and that's tied to the amended time frame. And so while I think given her testimony that she communicated with appellant across three different platforms, text messages, Facebook messages, and Xbox, and there were more text messages, and she had testified that these extortionate threats occurred in the same manner, that there was probably enough to survive a 917 motion. To your specific question about legal sufficiency, unlikely that it would survive proof beyond a reasonable doubt that.
So then, going from there, let's say that the panel members had, by exceptions and substitutions, changed the charge sheet on their own. Based on the precedence of this court having to do with material variance, fatal variance, would it have survived? Would the conviction have survived scrutiny on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, I think if we're applying the rule, the different rule for variance and the case law applying variance, I think there's actually a potential it could survive on appeal, not necessarily that the court would not find a fatal variance in the change of dates. I don't know if the court would or not. But assuming that the court finds a fatal variance, given the sheer number of days, they would still test for prejudice under the standard applicable to variance. And so when we start walking through what the prejudice analysis is, it's, is there a double jeopardy concern? There's not in this case. He actually has more protection from double jeopardy with the expanded charge time frame. Was he misled in the preparation of his defense? Well, it's the same factors that we've already talked about in why the defense did not rely upon these dates in forming its trial strategy. And so, Your Honor, I think the answer is yes, it would survive on appeal, not necessarily because of a lack of error, but because of a lack of prejudice under the fatal variance analysis.
So,
could you just explain the point you made about double jeopardy, that he had expanded protection because the dates were greater? Are you saying that because the dates were greater now, he couldn't be retried? But if we found it was a variance, he could be retried for anything that happened within those 279 days. Is that what your understanding is?
I believe so, Your Honor. It's the same extortionate threats just applied over a broader period of time is my point, that he has that protection over that broader period of time. And I guess one of the things that what was raised earlier that I think bears discussion is the notion of fundamental fairness as it applies to RCRM 603. The rule itself contemplates protecting the accused if there is going to be an issue with fundamental fairness. A minor change is any except those which fall within four specifically enumerated exceptions. Those that add a party, add an offense, substantial matter not fairly included, and something likely to mislead the accused as the offense charge. If there are issues with that based upon the facts and circumstances of this case, there shouldn't be a fundamental fairness concern. And if the charge constitutes a minor change, the accused has the benefit under paragraph 603C to have it further tested for prejudice to see if there's something else out there. And that didn't happen in this case. But the defense was unable to articulate any specific prejudice that was suffered.
Counsel, I'd like to give you an opportunity to address something that appellant's counsel raised. It's not in the briefs. He was talking about, in response to questions from Judge Hardy, perhaps there should be X number of days or a window of time, and then say there's a presumption that kicks in. How does that mesh with the plain language of 603, this presumption?
Your Honor, I don't think it meshes with the plain language of 603. To the extent there's a presumption that things are a minor change. There's no burden-shifting presumption or a presumption based upon a bright-line rule in the plain language of the rule. So I don't think if this Court is going to faithfully apply the language of the rule that is a rule that can or should be announced based upon this case. And I think, more to the point, this Court's precedent has looked at how to analyze dates, separate from United States v. Reese, where we're talking about amending the means of committing an offense, which actually implicated different defenses to the crime, or to the charge, excuse me. Or Mader, where there was actually a legal defense that was presented by the assault consummated by a battery charge that was not present in some other, an Article 92 charge. Here, correcting the dates, the number of days is immaterial unless time is of the essence. And that's a standard that's discussed in various terms in military precedent, whether it be the United States v. Brown from 1954 or 1992, or federal practice looking at amendments to charge timeframes under a analogous and closely related civilian rule of criminal procedure. And the offense of extortion is not offense defining. CL's age is not an element of the offense. It is not something that calls for an enhanced punishment of findings. Indeed, all the evidence of his pre-extortion and threats and then the evidence that is contained in the Facebook messages would have been admissible in sentencing. So there shouldn't be any prejudice at sentencing as well. So a bright-line rule tied to the number of dates, I think, is unworkable under RCRM 603. And, Your Honor, I think, getting back to the standard announced in United States v. Brown, the 1992 Brown, the dates of an offense are not are a matter of form rather than substance unless the dates are offense defining. These were the same parties, this was the same picture, and these were the same threats just applied to another time period. That's how the parties litigated this at trial. At trial, no one expressed the idea that this added an additional offense. The prejudice that the appellant articulated during the motion, the trial defense articulated during the motion, was just that this was an aggravating factor in sentencing, or that it made the Article 120B offense that was, in his telling, otherwise consensual, the product of coercion. But as a factual matter, that doesn't stand up to scrutiny. As I mentioned earlier, the evidence of pre-service extortion, CL's testimony, the Facebook messages were all admitted well prior to the amendment at issue, and therefore were a matter of litigation in the case. And I guess exploring another case that has been discussed in this oral argument, United States v. Reese. So in that case, it actually, the critical distinction beyond just changing the means of accomplishment for the trial, it didn't change anything else regarding the essential elements of the offense or the theory pursued by the government in the prosecution. As the military judge observed at trial, the theory for both Article 120B, or the theory for Article 120B, is open to the prosecution. Whether it was consensual, in fact, or non-consensual, is open to the government to prove however it sees fit. So the essential notice is not affected for that offense by evidence that this was actually produced under threat. And, Your Honor, I guess I will have a few more points about federal practice. RCM 603, the drafter's analysis, specifically refers to Federal Rule Criminal Procedure 7E, both for subparagraph A and subparagraph C. Now, it says, with regards to subparagraph C, this provision is based upon Federal Rule Criminal Procedure 7E, which is generally consistent with military practice. And courts that have applied 7E have consistently found that the dates of an offense are a matter of mere form rather than substance. And in the government's brief, we provide you with some examples. So in United States v. Gamble, the dates became a matter of substance because it actually prevented the government from returning a conviction before the statute of limitations had expired. So the dates actually were critical in that offense, in that case. Similarly, in United States v. Goldberg, the dates were critical because it was a tax case, and they had alleged that the crime must have been committed by 15 April. But the evidence adduced at trial showed that the defendant did not have a duty to file his return until later in May. And so by the military or by the district court judge permitting the case to go forward with that amended date, the court found that time was of the essence. The date actually created the offense. It transformed innocent conduct to criminal conduct. This case is more like United States v. Cena, where the court permitted a amendment to the charge time frame of up to, by 2 years because the dates were not essential. Time was not of the essence with regards to the conspiracy that was charged. Nothing about the offense of extortion meant that time was of the essence. And the Article 120B offense, to the extent that time was of the essence, it was just because it was a statutory rape charge, not for the other reasons articulated by the government or by the appellant. And barring any additional questions, I'll briefly conclude. You are in conclusion, correcting the dates of appellant's extortion threats did not add a party, an offense, or a substantial matter not fairly included. It did not mislead the appellant in preparing or mounting his defense. These were the same parties, the same picture, and the same threats, just applied to a different time. Consistent with RCM 603, this court's precedent, and federal practice interpreting that federal rule of procedure, this court should find it was a minor change. Thank you.
Thank you, Major Patera. Captain Mosner.
Airman Simmons was entitled to rely on the charge sheet and the government's subsequent decision not to amend the charge sheet prior to trial. An accused doesn't get to find out what they are defending against during a court-martial, or even worse, after the government rests its case, and the defense has already indicated that they intend to not pursue a case. As stated, our primary position is that this was a major change. You can arrive at this result because it's not a slight error on par with correcting a typo in my client's name, or because this is a substantial matter not fairly included in the previous preferral due to it changing the nature and the identity of two charges across two specifications at the same time.
But how did it change the nature or the identity of the crime? It's just better evidence, right? I mean, they've got testimony within the dates. They've got hard evidence outside the dates. But, like, how else? I mean, that's a significant difference, but what's the other meaningful difference?
The nature and identity gets changed. We can look at United States versus Parker, where that language is invoked and specifically discussed in that opinion is that dates were a major focus of the litigation. And changing the dates in that case altered the entire scope of the offenses that the parties were dealing with in that case. Now, when you look at a nature of an offense that's changed, perhaps you look at the core identity of the underlying facts and circumstances. Perhaps an Article 120B offense on its face could be dealing with a 12-year-old victim. It could be dealing with a 3-year-old victim. The nature and identity of those core allegations are very different. And in this case, when you have a strict liability crime where that is specifically tied to the age of 16, and the same charge sheet where you have an extortion started specifically as part of litigation strategy that starts after she turns 16, and then after the government rests, those are temporally reversed. So the threat causes the act. That changes the nature and identity of the offenses that appellant thought he was defending against. That's
but
why
none of the elements are different for the offenses. The things that the government had to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, none of that changed.
That's correct, Your Honor, but that's also not determinative. Because in the 1992 Brown case, we see the term offense defining. But in that comes from 1954 Brown case, where we talk about where time is of the essence. And time was of the essence in this court-martial. All counsel, all witnesses, everyone made this case about the calendar. So time was of the essence in this case. And when a particular crime occurred, under the facts of this case, the nature and identity of the charged offenses changed. So this case presents one of a major change because the intricate linkage that was absent on the charge sheet occurred after the government rested. That is a substantial matter not fairly included. That the act or that the threat caused the act is a substantial matter. It was likely to mislead the accused. We know that because, although it doesn't have to, it did mislead the accused into walking into opening statement and saying, we are going to attack the sloppily charged dates. And because of the change, he couldn't.
Chief,
thank you, Your Honor.
Chief, can I ask one quick question? You just referenced this court's decision in Brown in 1954. Do you believe that that decision is still relevant in how we interpret 603A?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. As a preliminary matter, Brown may be distinguishable because that involved a post-Article 32 pre-referral change. Our case, obviously, factually different. To the extent that point two, time was of the essence as a reason a change could be major, our case, time is of the essence. And third, Brown in 1954 also discussed that the accused in that case was not misled in any way. In our case, he was likely to be misled, and we know that by how he walked into voir dire and opening statement through the end of the presentation of the case. So to the extent Brown could be distinguishable based upon when the time or when the change was made, that may be one direction to go. But even in engaging in the substance of what Brown stands for, it actually supports appellant's position that this was a major change. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Chief Judge Olson.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel on both sides. And the court is in recess until further order of the court.